We're at that time of year where it's a little bit of a challenge to keep any sort of a series going, especially on Sunday evenings. There's a lot of interruptions. It's been 2 weeks now since we've been in Leviticus here, but I'm going to do my best to just kind of keep us going, marching forward, even with the interruptions that come up throughout the next month here. So we're picking up tonight back in Leviticus chapter 7. Leviticus 7 is the end of this first section of what I was calling the procedure manual for the Old Testament sacrificial system. If I said visualize it like a manual that you could pull down that says, here's what the procedures are for sacrifices, and think of two tabs in that manual. The first tab was the tab for the worshipers. It told the worshipers about what kind of sacrifices they could bring for each offering, what animals were required, what they needed to do, those types of details. The next tab, the second part of that manual, that runs through what we're looking at this evening, and that we began already, deals with what the priests needed to know about the sacrifices. What were their role when it came to offering a sacrifice? What should they do when a worshiper brought one of these sacrifices to the tent of meeting? And they needed to lead the congregation in the worship. That was a privilege they had, but it was also an enormous responsibility. They were representing the people to God, and they were representing God to the people. So that responsibility required that everything be done in proper order. God was very concerned about how he was approached in worship. He is a holy God. There had to be a proper approach to worshiping him, to approaching a holy God. These were sinners that were bringing sacrifices. There had to be an atonement for the sin. The whole focus of the system emphasized that over and over, that there had to be a proper procedure, a satisfaction for a worshiper to be able to enter the presence of the holy God. So the procedures really needed to be nailed down for the priests on what they had to do. Just a quick review of the sacrifices. We've seen five different main sacrifices. We had the burnt offering, the whole burnt offering. We had the meal offering, the peace offering. Those were sacrifices that were given by worshipers that already had communion with God in place. The proper atonement had been made, so these were sacrifices of various categories of worship. But then there were two more sacrifices for those that needed to be made when the worshiper was out of communion and wanted to get back into communion with God. Worship or sacrifices for communion. That was the purification offering and the reparation offering, when repayment had to be made. So those were the sacrifices introduced in the first five chapters. And then chapter 6 and 7, when we're dealing with the procedures for the priests themselves, they're organized in a different sequence than we saw in the first five chapters. The sequence really laid down around the frequency that the sacrifices were offered. The burnt offering and the meal offerings were the most frequent. They were regular daily offerings, so they came first. Then the purification offering was made at various festivals, and that was mentioned. The reparation offering was needed whenever certain kinds of sins were committed, and so that came fairly frequently because of those sins. And then the final offering, the one that we'll be spending our time on this evening, is the peace offering. The peace offering was essentially an optional offering. It was an offering that was made when a worshiper wanted to really celebrate what he had with God, the communion that he had with God. The peace offering was a shared meal. It was one where the worshiper, the one who brought the offering, was celebrating with everyone assembled in the sanctuary the benefits of a peaceful relationship with God. It was a sacrifice of rejoicing because of the wonderful privilege that we have peace with God, and that God has provided various blessings. So it was a celebratory offering. That's why it was an optional one. There was nothing that mandated it be offered other than joy. Now we'll see there are various things that, because of choices that a worshiper would make in that joy, we'll see a couple types where, or one type where they have to do it as part of the process, but it was one that was never obligatory to the worshiper to initiate. I'll explain that as we get to it. So anyway, that's the offering we want to focus on this evening, the peace offering. So we're in Leviticus chapter 11, and we're picking up, Leviticus chapter 7, we're picking up in verse 11. We'll get that right yet. 7-Eleven always gets me. Actually, no, I don't like Slurpee, so I don't go there very often. So we're in verse 11 of chapter 7. And I want to read through verse 21 just to put this all in place. This is where we actually see the details about the priest's role in the peace offering. Now this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which shall be presented to the Lord. If he offers it by way of thanksgiving, then along with the sacrifice of thanksgiving, he shall offer unleavened cakes mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil, and cakes of well-stirred fine flour mixed with oil. With the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving, he shall present his offering with cakes of leavened bread. Of this he shall present one for everything as a contribution to the Lord. It shall belong to the priest who sprinkles the blood of the peace offerings. Now as for the flesh of the sacrifice of his thanksgiving, peace offerings, it shall be eaten on the day of his offering. He shall not leave any of it over until morning. But if the sacrifice of his offering is a votive or free will offering, it shall be eaten on the day that he offers his sacrifice, and on the next day what is left of it may be eaten. But what is left over from the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day shall be burned with fire, so that if any of the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings should ever be eaten on the third day, he who offers it will not be accepted, and it will not be reckoned to his benefit. It shall be an offensive thing, and the person who eats of it will bear his own iniquity. Also, the flesh that touches anything unclean shall not be eaten. It will be burned with fire. As for other flesh, anyone who is clean may eat such flesh. But the person who eats the flesh of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which belong to the Lord in his uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from his people. When anyone touches anything unclean, whether human uncleanness or an unclean animal or any unclean detestable thing, and eats of the sacrifice or eats of the flesh of the sacrifice of peace offerings which belong to the Lord, that person shall be cut off from his people. So as I said, we're focusing in here on the role that the priests had for the various types of peace offerings. There's really three types of peace offerings that are spelled out in the section we just read. So because this was the role of the priest, with an offering that for the first time involves the worshiper being part of the actual process, the worshiper is invited to participate in eating of the offering, that combination requires there to be additional information provided. There's a lot more parameters of things that need to be considered when the worshiper is also part of the consuming of the sacrifice. But this was a very important offering because if you think about it, as one commentator said, the culmination of worship and its greatest joy is to enter the presence of God and celebrate being at peace with him. Think about that for a moment. To be at peace with the holy God. The whole point of the sacrificial system is to emphasize that our sin ruptured the peace between man and God. There was a divide that was created between the Creator and his creature because of sin. And now there is a means by which God has provided so that man can once again be at peace with him. That's something to be celebrated. That is the heart of worship. So that's what makes this offering so important. Now, it was the responsibility of the spiritual leader to ensure that everything was done correctly, that there was proper purity maintained, that there was the right kind of generosity that was characterized by the celebration. So let's look at some of the details. When the peace offering came, the offerer brought a gift to the Lord for a communal meal. So he's bringing gifts, presenting it to the Lord, but it's for celebration in a communal meal. The Baptists were not the first to have potluck services. It goes back in ancient history here. But he brought this animal for the meal, that was part of the meal, that was the sacrifice that went with the meal. But the worshiper also had to bring other items for this meal. He had to bring these cakes and these wafers. And we see in verse 12, there were cakes and wafers that were made with unleavened, or they were unleavened cakes. Those were the cakes that were essentially a meal offering. They went to the Lord. They were for the priest. They were not for the communal meal. They were leavened. They were set up, or they were unleavened. They were set apart. They were special in the sacrifice and were given to the Lord and could be consumed only by on the altar by the Lord's representatives. But along with the animal for the meal and along with these cakes, the worshiper also brought cakes and wafers that were leavened, or cakes rather that were leavened in verse 13. And that leavening made them common. They were things that could be consumed by others. They were still dedicated to the Lord. They were part of the celebration, but they were common and could be eaten by all the worshipers that were present. So let's consider the first type. The first type we encounter here in verse 12 is the thanksgiving peace offering. If he offers by way of thanksgiving, it's a thanksgiving peace offering. Thanksgiving may not be the best word to translate the idea that's being expressed here in the Hebrew. The idea is one of acknowledgement, or it's an idea of praise that's being offered. In a public form, the worshiper wants to praise God for what God has done. He wants to edify other people by drawing attention to what God has done, and he wants to do this in the form of a communal meal that they are all going to enjoy. He's acknowledging that God has done something special, and that God deserves praise for what he has done in this person's life. And that's why he brings this offering. It was an expression of gratitude to God for his intervention. Oftentimes this would be used if the worshiper was delivered from peril. In fact, flip over to Psalm 22 is one example where we can see this offering being given. We've already, in our work through the Psalms, we've gone past Psalm 22. When this psalm here that David wrote in verse 22 of Psalm 22, all the way through verse 31, David is really rehearsing his peace offering. He's praying in advance to God what he will say when God answers his prayer. In verse 22 says, "I will tell of your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you." And then he goes on to say how that praise will be developed. That's the picture here of a priest offering. David's anticipating that God will answer this prayer, and when he does, he's committing himself, "God, I will tell of this before others. I will take and praise you in the sanctuary, in the temple." And the way he would do that, the form that God provided for that was this peace offering, that he would bring a sacrifice and these things to the temple so that it could be given as an offering. So we see back in Leviticus that this thanksgiving is brought, and while the animal was cooking on the fire, the offer is to declare then his thanksgiving. He is to stand up and tell why he is offering this. The congregation is to know why they're sharing in this bounty. They'll get to eat of some of the meat here that's been offered. Why? What's the purpose behind it? It's not like this is where it very much goes away from our potlucks. We have no idea why we're eating Donna's curry chicken up there other than we enjoy it. No, we don't stand up and give praise specifically before we give an offering, but here they're giving praise in the temple, specifically while the feast is being prepared by the priests. They're giving word to the congregation what is behind this, what I am not acknowledging here with God. As I said, they bring these cakes then that are both unleavened, that would go to God and the priest, and leavened that the rest of the worshipers could eat. Now in verse 14, he says he should present one of these offerings as a contribution to the word. That word contribution, in some of your versions, especially like the King James Version, traditionally it was translated as a heave offering. It made it sound like this was a different offering. But the word basically seems to just mean a contribution, that he presents all of these things as his contribution. He's giving these things to God here as the peace offering of thanksgiving or of praise. He dedicated it. It was set apart for this purpose. Now, since this was a peace offering, all those who were present at the service could eat of that communal meal. And the principle that was being highlighted here for everybody as God instituted this into the system was that God wanted people to recognize, he wanted his people to recognize that he would bless certain individuals in order that others might be blessed by their generous sharing, and that all together we would rejoice in what God has done. It was designed to bring the community together, to celebrate what God has done. Maybe I personally did not experience the blessing from God, this particular blessing, the deliverance that's being celebrated, but I can rejoice that it happened to Benjamin over here who brought the offering. And I should praise God for what he did for Benjamin and for Benjamin's generosity in sharing that blessing with me. It brings us all together. And that's what God wants, if to understand that the reason he blesses certain individuals is not so that they can indulge themselves based on the blessings that he gave. It's so that they can rejoice in community of faith with others over what God has done and to be generous in sharing of what God has done. We may not think about it very much in our day and age, but to bring these offerings, this was an expensive offering. It was not something that was easy to do for the average Israelite. And in fact, some scholars suggest that probably the only time most Israelites, the common Israelite, ate meat was when they were at the temple with one of these offerings. They just did not have meat as a normal basis. It was too expensive. It was too restricted to be able to have that. So it's a generous offering that was being brought. Now, it is consumed on the same day that's called out very specifically. This Thanksgiving is, it needs to be consumed on the same day, according to verse 15. But it doesn't really say why. Some speculate that maybe that is to stress that the acknowledgement of the benefit should be made while it's fresh. That's just speculation. I don't really know why God spells out that this offering, the offering of thanksgiving, that praise offering, needs to be all consumed on one day. Maybe it's so that the one worshiper would not hoard a portion for his family more than they could eat, but it has to be shared with everybody there. So it's shared broadly and it gets consumed. We don't know any details beyond what we have in the verse there. But then we do move into a second and third type of praise offering. These are like subcategories of praise offerings. The second one is listed here in verse 16, if the sacrifice of his offering is a votive. A votive might be, might have it translated as a vow offering. This is when a person has chosen to make a vow, and that's where the voluntary part comes. A person's not forced to make a vow, but when he's chosen to make a vow or has made that vow to God, as part of the fulfillment of that vow, he concludes it with an offering. Probably the most familiar example we have of that in Scripture is in Acts chapter 21. If you remember when Paul came back to the city there, and there was people thinking that he had been teaching false doctrine, he was going against the Jews, and the church in Jerusalem told him, well, we've got these guys, they're just finishing up their vows, take and pay their vow fee. Well, that's what this would be. Paul took in and provided for this offering that completed their vow. So that's the second type of a peace offering. And so making and paying vows followed the same sacrificial ritual as the celebratory praise offering or the thanksgiving offering. There was no difference as far as how the process went beyond what was motivating it. The third type that's mentioned here is the free will offering. And free will is a very good translation. It's just a completely voluntary offering. The thanksgiving offering is a praise for something God has specifically done. The vow offering is complete, a voluntary vow that was taken. A free will offering is just an overflowing amount of joy that caused a worshiper want to bring an offering. It wasn't really motivated by any specific thing other than the fact that there's joy in having a relationship with God. And being part of the people of God and being under the covenant blessings of God in general. So the free will offering was just that, a free will to bring a sacrifice to the temple. And again, the same ritual would be followed. So the votive and the free will offerings, they were more spontaneous than the praise offering, and that may be the reason that they could be eaten on 2 days versus only 1 day. But again, it's not really stressed or not really explained why. It just says that in their case, that what is left over on the first day may be eaten on the next day. But there is great stress that's placed on the aspect of purification here in these offerings. Purification both for the sacrifice and the worshiper. Because, again, the emphasis is being placed on the holiness of God. That which is offered to God had to be pure. That which is in communion with God must be pure. That which is celebrated in the presence of God must be pure. So there's great emphasis on that. And the priests had to understand that. They had to ensure that nothing unclean was present. Since the peace offering was publicly proclaiming that all is well with God, that everything is in harmony, in communion with God, and any kind of uncleanness represented the exact opposite. There was a division between God created by uncleanness that represented sin. So the priests had to ensure that everything that came, that was involved here, was clean and pure. So anything eaten at a time other than the allotted time was offensive. It became essentially unclean. That word offensive in verse 18, as we follow through here, is basically the idea of desecrated. It's unacceptable to eat it outside the appropriate time. It becomes an offensive thing. And notice that the person who eats that, who eats it outside the designated window, will bear his own iniquity. Eating negated for the one who offered it, such eating outside that designated window, if the worshiper himself saved over some of the meat to take outside the designated window of 1 day or 2 days, depending on the specifics, for that worshiper, doing such negated God's acceptance of the offering. The entire point of giving praise to God is negated. God no longer likes the praise, no longer accepts the praise. In fact, the offender, it says, will bear responsibility for his actions. He will bear his own iniquity. He is no longer even in communion with God. Now he needs a purification offering. He has sin that has separated him from God and is warranting punishment. Again, it seems like the reason there's so much being spelled out here in details along this line is because when it comes to the peace offerings, the regulations are not as strict as for the burnt offerings. More people are involved. There's more things happening here. Not as strict as for those. So the likelihood of contamination is greater. The sacrificial meat might be laying around for a day. Well, there's a chance that could become unclean during that time. It's being dispersed to a greater number of people. There's a chance that it could come in contact with uncleanliness through that process. So there's greater likelihood for contamination, so there's greater need for clarification about what is clean. When you had the burnt offering or the meal offering that's given to the priest, it's clean at that point. The priest is clean. He puts it on the altar. It's consumed. There's not a lot of opportunity for that which was clean to become unclean, to have contamination. So verses 19 through 21 really hammer out these specifics about keeping it from being defiled, with the emphasis that anyone who ate something defiled or ate while in a defiled state, we see here these words, they were cut off from the people. They're cut off because to eat was claiming to have peace with God, and being unclean was, in fact, to not be at peace with God. So to consume in that combination where you're mixing clean and unclean together like that was a violation, and considered a very severe violation. Now these two words, cut off, that we have there, it's a very common penalty in the book of Leviticus. It comes up frequently. If you just do a search on it, or as we work our way through, we'll see this word numerous times. Even tonight, we'll find multiple times this word cut off, that they'll be cut off from the people. The problem is, its precise meaning is unclear. We see it frequently, and we can tell it's a very severe penalty, but we don't know exactly what the penalty is. And most likely, It was some level of excommunication from the community. It probably involved a disinheritance by the community until the person would deal with it. They're not part of God's people. It seems to have that indication that they were part of the nation. They're cut off. They're logically considered separated from the nation. But some do suggest that cut off may even mean that there would be a direct judgment by God. Because as we work our way through the book of Leviticus, some of the things for which a person is cut off, in practical consideration, God would be the only one who knew that the person has committed these offenses. This particular offense might not be so unknown, but there's, as I said, we'll see this come up other time, and there's a lot of items that really only God and the person would know, because they're things done in secret. And yet, if that's done, if a person commits these crimes, they're cut off. So some suggest from that maybe cut off involves a direct judgment by God. It is a severe penalty. That much we know. It's a severe penalty, and it's a more severe penalty than the one that was given simply to one who ate the sacrifice after the prescribed deadline. That person, it said, bore his own iniquity. This, to mix clean and unclean, is more severe. It involves this cutting off. And because it's more severe, verse 21 gives us a definition of what it means to be unclean. And there's various types of uncleanness that can prohibit a person from worship. And these, we get the definition here in verse 21, but the definition is fleshed out later in the book of Leviticus. Especially in chapter 22, we see a number of things listed, but we also see in chapter 11, chapters 12 through 15, various explanations that flush out these details about what things can cause a person to be unclean. That we can have greater explanation about what does it mean to have human uncleanness or have an unclean animal or an unclean detestable things. This is just the summary definition. But again, it's emphasized that the penalty here, that person shall be cut off. So two times in two verses here, we have this penalty being mentioned. That emphasizes that in a very emphatic fashion. This is the penalty for mixing clean and unclean together. So uncleanness cannot be part of the peace offering. A celebration of peace with God through blood in this public service of praise is for the benefit that has come from the relationship that one has with God, has no room for any sort of hypocrisy. And it's hypocritical for a person who is ceremonially unclean through any of these ways to participate in that. That's the emphasis here. God will not harbor hypocrisy from his worshipers. He wants purity in his worship. So now, as we understand that, now we kind of, this wraps up the last offering, and we start closing out this section with just some things that apply now to all the offerings. And we'll run through those hopefully a little bit quicker here. In verses 22 through 27, we find a prohibition summarized about eating the fat and the blood. Let's read these verses. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall not eat any fat from an ox, a sheep, or a goat. Also the fat of an animal which dies, and the fat of an animal torn by beasts may be put to any other use, but you must certainly not eat it. For whoever eats the fat of the animal from which an offering by fire is offered to the Lord, even the person who eats shall be cut off from his people. You are not to eat any blood, either of bird or animal, in any of your dwellings. Any person who eats any blood, even that person shall be cut off from his people." So we know we're in a new section here. If you look at verse 22, then the Lord spoke to Moses, and we have in verse 23, "Speak to the sons of Israel." Those are code formulas that says, okay, we're in a new section now. So we're really in, you might think, almost a new tab, summary matters. This is wrapping things up here of what the priests need to know. As he shifts from the rituals around each of the individual offerings to the rituals that deal specifically with fat and blood that would apply across all the offerings. Fat, as we've mentioned earlier when we first encounter it, it represents the best. And the best must be given to God. God does not want secondary items. He demands the best in worship. Now we should recognize, I know this always was a stumble for me as a kid. Why would fat be considered the best? I don't want to eat the fat. Well, fat is this. The word covers more than just what we think of as fat. Let's put it that way. This is the best. This is some of the choice piece of the animal. It refers to the best portions of the healthiest animals, being more than what we would consider actual fat. And what we see here is even the fat from an animal that is fit for sacrifice could not be eaten if it died either naturally or by violence. If you had take a lamb, we know them as the best for sacrifice, a good lamb that would be a great sacrifice. If something happened to that lamb and it died, well, this portion of that animal could not be consumed. The fat could not be eaten. Even though the animal had never been offered in the temple, it was still considered that portion that belonged to God, because fat could not be consumed. To eat the fat was an encroachment on divine property. This was God's. Whether it was brought to the temple or not, it was God's. And it could not be consumed. And to do that resulted in the same punishment as one who ate sacrificial meat while in that state of uncleanness. They were cut off again. The ban against eating fat here is restricted to sacrificial animals. For those animals, the ox, the sheep, or the goat, those things that could be brought as sacrifices. But when we get to the blood in verse 26, there's a universal prohibition. It goes beyond just the sacrificial animals. Blood could not be consumed, period. Blood represented life, and life belonged to God. Life belongs to God because God is the giver and God is the taker of life. It's his life, and the blood represents that. So the ban on the blood was not restricted to the sacrificial animals. It wasn't restricted to the sanctuary grounds. It applied to Jews wherever they lived, which really helps, just a side note here, explain the prohibition that we see in Acts chapter 15. If you remember the Jerusalem Council, when Paul comes down with... Is it Barnabas? I'm drawing a blank here. It's been saying yes. Barnabas from Antioch, and they tried to figure out, they've got the issues with Gentile churches, what prohibition should we demand of Gentiles? And the Jews said, this one thing, one of the things they said is they cannot eat the blood. It's because of this prohibition. It was so ingrained to the Jews, they couldn't eat a blood at any time. It would be very offensive. And said, don't do that. Yeah. Great sanctity goes with the sacrificial worship. So the portions of the sacrifice that are set apart to the Lord had to be treated as holy, and the blood then had to be treated as holy. And punishment for violation was severe. They would be cut off in both cases. Now in verses 28 through 36, we have another little section here. Again, summarizing which portions of the food, let's just wrap it up, which priests, here's what you get. So it summarizes the priest's portions. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, he who offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his offering to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hands are to bring offerings by fire to the Lord. He shall bring the fat with the breast, that the breast may be presented as a wave offering before the Lord. The priest shall offer up the fat and the smoke on the altar, but the breast shall belong to Aaron and his sons. You shall give the right thigh to the priest as a contribution from the sacrifices of your peace offerings. The one among the sons of Aaron who offers the blood of the peace offerings and the fat, the right thigh shall be his as his portion. For as I have taken the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of contribution from the sons of Israel, from the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons, as they do forever from the sons of Israel. This is that which is consecrated to Aaron and that which is consecrated to his sons from the offerings by fire to the Lord in the day that he presented them to serve as priests to the Lord. These the Lord had commanded to be given them from the sons of Israel to the day in the day that he anointed them. This is their due forever throughout their generations. Again, we have that same shift. We have that introductory formula. The Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the sons of Israel. That tells us we're shifting into another summary here. another subsection. And this emphasizes, it begins with the duty of the worshiper to bring an offering to the Lord from their offerings, specifically their peace offerings here. He emphasizes that it's to be done with his own hands. The worshiper is to participate here and show that he is to be devoted and deliberate and to be public with everything he's doing here. He's giving this of his own hand, this offering. But then it, again, summarizes the fat goes entirely to the Lord. That was emphasized in the previous section. It's emphasized here again. But then we find the breast is mentioned. The breast was a good cut of meat. It's not entirely clear why it would go to the priest. It just does. It's given to the priest, along with the right thigh that's offered as a second contribution. Again, that's that word that traditionally in like the King James is translated heave, but means a contribution, that which was dedicated. Again, we don't really know why the right thigh was designated that way, but it is. What we should note, though, is the sequence. The priest, first of all, must burn the choice portions for God, that the fat must be burned. And only after that can the priest receive his contribution. For the priest to mix that up would be a violation. Think of the sons of Eli at the entrance to the tent where they were not following this, and it was an offense to God. The priest was to, first of all, give God what God deserves, then the priest could receive what he deserved. After that, then the worshiper can have what he has. We should recognize that the priest had no income other than the tithes and the offerings of the people. And this is the way God provides for him. In fact, it's very striking. In verse 34, that we suddenly have a first-person pronoun entering in, a first-person verb, "For I have taken the breast." God speaks up. It underscores the truth that this donation that went to the priest was there by divine appointment. But it's all to be done in a way that was public, that was seen by everyone. The worshipers were to give that, and all this is done out there where everybody knows what's going on, that this is how the priest is receiving his due as the Lord has commanded. And then verse 35 just clarifies the provision that the priests begin to receive this when they're legitimately priests. They have to be consecrated. They have to be anointed as priests before they can receive any of this. It doesn't go to any of the priestly family line or anything of that nature, anyone that is destined to become a priest. It's when they're anointed. And that actually kind of sets us up, because that's the subject of the next section of the book. The next procedural manual will enter is, how do the priests become anointed? Well, we'll get to that. But that it's only after they're anointed that they can receive this. If an offering was given to God, then only God's chosen ministers could take from it. There's a connection there again. And now we summarize all of this in verses 37 and 38. This is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the sin offering, and the guilt offering, and the ordination offering, and the sacrifice of peace offerings. When the Lord commanded Moses at Mount Sinai in the day that he commanded the sons of Israel to present their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. These verses wrap up this whole section, the whole procedural manual that deals with the sacrifices. This is the law that has a collective force to it. This is God's prescription for how it is to occur. And the various offerings of the system are listed. The one that pops out when we look at that is the ordination offering, because when we went through the first five chapters and we saw the offerings laid out, that one wasn't mentioned. It wasn't really mentioned until we got to chapter 6, verses 19 through 20. It makes a brief appearance, because that's the specific offering that's given by a priest when he is ordained for the offering. So it wasn't introduced in the common directory. It wasn't something that the worshiper would bring. It was something that a priest would bring at that one time when he had to be ordained. But again, the emphasis in this summary is that these are God's instructions. These are from the Lord, from Yahweh. They're God. And we just note historically there from verse 38, it makes it very clear that these sacrifices began immediately at Mount Sinai when the law was given. So all through their wilderness journeys. While they spent those 40 years, the sacrificial system was part of what they were engaged in. It began at the very beginning of giving them receiving the law from God. So we have all this detail here. And just summarize what we see here. Worship, especially think about the peace offering now, worship is to be a shared experience. It is to be filled with gratitude, with joy. It is to have a generous spirit. And God, in his graciousness, provided a way for the Old Testament believer to express such. He provided these different offerings so that they could have communion with him, that sin could be covered. And then he gave a special way that they could celebrate together what they had from God. But we also should recognize in this that worship is a serious business. If the worshiper is entering into the presence of the holy God, God was very specific about the forms and the functions within the ritual that's in all of those things that we looked at. All these details emphasize that fact. So the reason I wanted to push the Lord's Supper to the end of the service is the Lord's Supper serves very much the same purpose as the peace offering for us as New Testament believers. There's a lot of overlap here. In fact, I can easily say that the peace offering really finds its fulfillment in the New Testament Lord's Supper. When we partake of the Lord's table, we are praising God for his deliverance. When we go through the words of the supper, think about the words, "This bread represents the body that is broken for me. This cup represents the blood that was shed for me." We are celebrating that God provided a way that we could be in communion with him. We were sinners that could not have communion with God until our sin was covered, but he provided a way for that. So we celebrate that we are in communion with him, but it's a shared experience. It's a celebratory meal that we are to take together. It's not something we do individually in an isolated fashion. We share our experience of joy that we have in receiving this great salvation from God with others who have experienced the same. We celebrate the table together. Now, when we do it, we are to have a generous spirit towards one another. We're to have a generous spirit because of the generosity that we've received. And as I've mentioned at other times, when in the Church of Corinth, when we look at the context there, the problem, one of the significant problems in the Church of Corinth is they were celebrating this meal after showing a very selfish spirit. They were having meals where some were feasting and others and getting drunk, and others were going hungry, displaying great individual selfishness, and then coming together for a meal that celebrates what they have in common. No, when we take this meal, we're to have a generous spirit, just like the peace offering was a result of a generous spirit for what God has done. We have received so much from God that we are to be generous. We should also, as we celebrate the Lord's table, especially in the context of thinking now about the peace offering, realize that we need to be very careful how we partake of the elements of the table. God hasn't changed at all. He is still a holy God. It is still an amazing fact that a holy God has provided a means whatsoever for his people to enter his presence. We dare not take that for granted. In fact, as the Corinthians were doing, and as we're reminded oftentimes, I take the time to remind us when we come to the meal, it was such a serious thing that Paul reminded the Corinthians that some of them had been cut off in the most literal way fashion or possible. They were taken, their life was taken. It doesn't get much more dramatic cutting off than having your life taken because they had spurned the holiness of God in the way that they were partaking of the elements. We need to be mindful of that. We are warned in the New Testament about partaking of this table in a careless fashion. We're entering the presence of a holy God who knows all aspects of our heart. Remember I mentioned in Leviticus some of the things that people are cut off for are things that only God knows. God knows every aspect of our heart. So we need to be very careful. We dare not partake of these if we're, by partaking of them, being hypocritical. The whole issue we saw in Leviticus there in those verses 19 through 21 dealt with hypocrisy, that we were pretending, or they were pretending to be clean when they were unclean, and they were mixing the profane with the sacred, and it could not be tolerated. God would not tolerate it. We need to be just as mindful and be very careful. We dare not be hypocritical, especially Paul emphasizes when we partake of the meal that we are celebrating our communion with God, so we dare not, or with God through Jesus Christ, we dare not partake of these elements if we don't have that relationship with Jesus Christ that allows us to have communion with God. But we're also celebrating the community we have with each other through Christ. So we're not to partake of these elements if we are not in harmony with one another. We are to avoid doing that so we are not mixing the profane with the holy. The supper was instituted by God. Through Jesus, he was our peace offering. So we should partake in obedience and worship. So what we are going to do at this time is transition with a hymn to allow our deacons to have a moment to transition, and then we will move in to the Lord's table as we think about how this fills out everything that we saw in Leviticus here about the peace offering.